Well, we're supposed to assess some sort of progress since the last meeting 3 years ago, and I do have a filing system that works sometimes, so I discovered this in my file from a session that Carl Gwynne and I ran here in 1999. And so just take a quick look through this and you'll be able to see how the emphasis has changed from then to now. Okay, in some ways it's similar, in some ways it's very different. So just a little historical perspective. Okay? You can identify your favorite topic up here, which probably won't be discussed today, but we'll see. So I prepared a quasi-outline, which has some structure in it, actually, but I hope most of this discussion will be unstructured. Of course, this reflects my particular point of view, but proceeding down in cleanliness, let's say, possibly, to answer the question which I paraphrased at the top, okay, we first like to have a discussion of the inspiral of little guys into big black holes. Okay, Scott Hughes discussed this mostly in the context of LISA. One question is, any shot for LIGO, neutron stars falling into 100 solar mass black holes, things like that we might discuss briefly. Scott mentioned the probably unimportant effects of the spin of the little guy interacting with the spin of the big guy or with the orbit, as well as the probably small effects of an accretion disk, both viscous and gravitational. Another question is, what do you use as your model for violations of Kerr? He mentioned perturbations of Kerr. Another question, how many multiple moments can you really measure in the in-spiral, et cetera? So those are some of the issues that people might want to address in this session for this test. Then for the QPOs, in my view, probably the most important question is, what is the equilibrium model? Is there an equilibrium model? How stationary is it? Is the gas plus radiation pressure really much greater than the magnetic pressure? So we can apply hydrodynamic concepts. What are the effects of the corona on the equilibrium model and therefore on the QPOs? Then I want Ron Remelod to say a few words about recent observations of one microquasar that wasn't discussed too much, 1915 plus 105, and some new results on some other black hole candidates. And then I'll use my chairman's prerogative to make a few comments about disco seismology, which may be new to some of you. And then Vlodek and maybe some others will discuss the resonance models for QPOs. And I hope we'll get into some discussion of how you form blobs in some of the other models and how these blobs survive. And then I'd like Emrod to talk just a little bit about something you may not be fully aware of, what we call a Compton microscope. It's a way to get at the location of the QPOs from the energy dependence of the fractional modulation, which was seen most strongly in 1915 plus 105. And I hope Ron and others will emphasize the increasing need for larger detectors and really why it's now really critical that we need these larger detectors. Okay, then moving to the line profiles. Are there any other models we should consider other than the ones that were discussed here? And what are the observational prospects for improving the data, getting more candidates, et cetera? We know some of those, but maybe not all of them. Then evidence for event horizons. Okay, to me a crucial issue is this strong inequality and these inequalities, which were talked about, really true. In particular, I think a very important issue: how do we measure any one of these guys, the net mass accretion rate, the inflow mass accretion rate, or the outflow, or the outflow mass rate? Okay. And from what Eric talked about, what are the prospects for gravitational self-lensing as providing evidence for an event horizon? There are existing models in the literature treating phase transitions of the vacuum to a different state, which have things that look like black holes but don't have an event horizon. So there are some models to be tested in principle. Finally, I just threw this in. What about the prospects for the holy grail of relativity to some people? A pulsar black hole binary at some high inclination angle, and how high does it have to be, how close to 90 degrees, to really be able to see interesting effects from the interaction of the pulsar signal with the black hole? And what's the likelihood of discovery? Vicky has left, but the point here is that the pulsar lifetime, since it's the second guy formed, will be short, and so that reduces the likelihood for discovery of these systems. So I hope there might be a few comments on this topic as well. So that's what I propose. And so would Scott or anyone else like to make any comments or provide any questions about the in-spiral?
I think I'll start by setting up the following scenario. You mentioned whether it might be possible to see such a large mass ratio kind of thing in supercritical to ground-based detectors. Seems to be, in order for volume, it would depend upon the mass of the large black hole, of course, but if it was sort of a 100 to 1 mass ratio where you might think you could submit the same thing, in order for the signal to really lie in the detector's bandwidth, it probably have to be fairly rapidly rotating. An orange 6 m plunge radius is probably too far out for the signal being in hand. And I wonder what the likelihood is of getting a black hole in that mass range that kind of spin through the people. Cole Miller, people thinking about them in the Hunter-Sorn mass range. Probably some important work on this as well, from multiple mergers building it up. It seems like you're going to have something being assembled from multiple mergers. Hard if there's a couple mergers happening where it could really be spun up with a large dike. It might be something smaller where the plunge radius would be too far out for it to be in band. So that's my way of hunting. Maybe pull from some of the other people.
No, I do agree with you. If you're building up 100 solar masses, black hole by accumulating 1 to 10 solar mass black holes from random direction, then the outer body will have something in the neighborhood of 0.1 or 0.2 at that time. It's probably not going to be checked. Even 100, I think, would use the plan to be more or less advanced by the detector in order to know that it's a good signal to go on. So
it depends, though, if you're able, in some circumstances, to build them up with accretion from a gas disk and has a given centrifugation, maybe the Earth doesn't sound like a little steam.
Any other input to this? So Scott, you felt that the spin question was not critical, right? As far as the effects of the spin of the little guy. It's not critical for Lisa, right?
My gut feeling based on what people do the calculation, it's not doing the calculation, but what the dynamics look like with small body spinning. But Sterl Finney and one of his graduate students have been doing it. And what they find is that the oscillations of the orbital elements due to the precession of the small body spin is not a very large effect. Essentially, it's an effect that is suppressed by the mass ratio of the system itself. So if you have a mass ratio that's 10 to the minus
right.
5 or 10 to the minus 6, it's not a big effect. I actually think one thing would be really
worth thinking about would be maybe a better understanding of what effects the thing spiraling through some kind of accreting material might impact on. I mean, Roach Narayan has looked at that, at least for the context of the ADAF models, and I don't know that field well enough. I wonder if there are other things out there that could really screw up the signal, prevent being able to do these kind of measurements.
Right, that's the key question. Any other influences? Yeah?
Just trying to respond to that and ask one question. I think one of the things people have talked about is finding a star, sort of a regular star, which gives an electromagnetic signal every time it goes through a thin disk and so on, and every time you get to the burst. And that, in principle, has orbital elements to provide a check of the metric. I think it's obviously not as good as doing gravitational radiation detection, but it could be something. The question is, the question I had for you was, would your multiple moment formalism be a good way of, devil's advocate sense of finding a black hole with a great Manet? Or finding, let's put a black box on a black hole with a great Manet.
Oh, gee.
If, just thinking about what the structure of the multipoles look like in that case, I think it might. I'm going through what it looks like in my head, and I think yes, it probably would be.
It probably could be. So that would be, sort of.
Right. I mean, one of the problems is that, of course, all these multiple. I mean, if I have a multiple moment that's of L of 5 or something like that, then it's got a 1/r⁶ impact on the fields. So you have to be fairly close in order to feel the effects of those higher order multiples. If you go far off, go out far enough, all you're feeling is the mass, and so. Although in principle it could be done, that kind of thing could be done. You could sort of test things in that way. I wonder whether these higher order multiples would actually have any kind of an effect, the kind of radius that you might be seeing from a star on one of these radii.
What would you mentioned some number for realistically how many multiple moments could be measured by LISA, right?
Right.
And you felt 3 was a rigorous lower limit for.
Oh, yeah. I strongly felt that. So Fenton Ryan has looked at this in the context of, so he sort of put together a toy model of a compact object with goofy multiple moments. It was a solitonic star or something like that, something like that of a scalar field condensation. And he looked at the end spiral of an object that was in a circular equatorial orbit and asked how many of the multiple moments could be measured from that using LISA. Mm-hmm. 3 was easy, what he basically found. Because he restricted the orbit to be circular and equatorial, I feel his answer is probably an underestimate, because there are other precessional frequencies when it's made eccentric or it's made out of the plane, which provide additional handles to go in and measure these multiples.
Right.
He completely ignored them in his analysis. My feeling is that being able to measure it from the more realistic orbits, probably 3 is definitely a lower bound. You can probably do quite a bit more than that.
The mass
of
the first
moment
of the other, yes.
Okay, well, for now, let's end that part of the discussion and turn to QPOs. now, Julian, do you want to say anything about the first point now, or anyone else? About the first point, the question is, could a QPO ever be seen in your simulations or other simulations? No, I'd like to know. I mean, what are the prospects?
I don't think there's anything terribly serious I can say about that now. And I also suspect that if we did find such a mechanism, that we wouldn't have a whole lot about testing any metric properties. Basically, whatever astrophysics we put in will be surely messier and more dubious than the nominal background which we might have.
Oh yeah, I'm not talking about that level, okay? I'm just here talking about the physics of QPOs, so we understand it to be used as a probe of strong gravity, okay? We'd like to have confidence in the physics of QPOs if we want to use them as probes.
That's right, but that's why I say it's probably going to go the other way around. But what I see is coming out of the great many QPO models
is that they're all at this stage largely lacking any way to turn the mode oscillation into a light modulation, other than providing a bright spot or a dark spot on shift, and then letting the relativistic properties modulate what we see.
I don't know quite what you mean, but we predict the temperature and pressure fluctuations, which I'll talk about, which modulate
the... integrate over this. If you didn't have the relativistic motion, would you get any net change in the velocity when you integrate over this?
Maybe Mike should respond to that. He's worked at it more.
For the lowest order mode, sure, you can get it. But that is the great worry, that as you go to more radial nodes or more azimuthal nodes, it's all going to break down and go off.
And then you reduce to maybe seeing things just because there's modulation due to relatively being
Not entirely true for that's true for high load numbers, but not true for lowest numbers.
They are fairly low.
Yeah.
And so they're modulating things as a whole.
So it's basically as soon as you get off any control.
Sure.
Anything that's pure axis symmetry in
But I think part of Bob's question for point number one that I think gets lost sometimes to me is, for any students watching on the web right now, gets lost in these discussions is that for the MHD modes, we're seeing some of the papers that talk about, well, and obviously that, well, we see there's more dissipation as you go to higher vertical height than it is. And obviously that's the corona. And you have turbulence that produces a turbulent power spectrum. And obviously that's the fluctuations that we actually see in the X-ray.
I wouldn't say that.
I think there's some tendency to believe that in people doing this. Not everybody, but some of the people doing this.
But the small number of people doing the simulation. And I think you can go head by head and find that when we see these fluctuations, we say, aha, this looks like a good noise source that after appropriate treatment might be reflected as a broadband noise in the light curve, but you got to do this and this and this before you translate these fluctuations into luminosity fluctuations.
But you know, separate, like, you know, as Rob and Ann talked in their talks and Dimitri talked in their talks, that we don't always see a corona, but you know, there's some inkling to the codes that it should always, the dissipation should always be getting more as you go to thinner atmospheres. But there are times when you don't see a corona at all. And there are times when you see just a nice disk in it, and it's just dead silent. So where has the MHD turbulence gone?
Yeah, that was, and in fact, when I learned the other day that in the high state, there is very little in the way of output fluctuations, I found that quite frightening. Because it is hard to square this picture of a very turbulent disk with a very quiet one.
That you were at 4 years ago.
Well, you know, why do you have to everything at the time?
Okay, just one comment. I mean, what I meant by here as well is, do the numerical people have the vertical boundary condition under control? That's what I meant by that. Now you can, you go, right.
You know the answer.
No.
Just to make a suggestion. I don't know whether this makes any sense, but in the case where you may have a truncated disk and a hot inner region, instead of thinking about it as a sort of very rapid inflow, think about it in the way that we used to think about it, as a sort of iron torus, a sort of quasi-stationary but optically thin emission. And one of the problems with that, which we may turn into a virtue, to the famous Papalozzi-Pringle instabilities, which were made to destroy them. And then there were some other problems with it, Zoma and others that worked on. But is it just possible that those modes, being excited at some sort of modestly nonlinear level, perhaps before they become planets or whatever, could be associated with one class of QPOs, and then they wouldn't have to be some transducing into a corona, because it could be non-thermal emission, X-ray emission made from the torus itself, which could be responsible for the QPO that's observed. It could be, you know, quite high energy X-rays.
And remain stable frequency?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it would require queues of, you know, tens or 15s. It's just the thought that, you know, it could be quite low frequency as well, because the chloride could be quite extended. Instead of thinking of them as very rapid inflows, thinking about them as rather slow inflows from quasi-stationary chloride with these instabilities that depend on getting a pretty good reflection of the inner edge of the torus for that, you know, for that excitation. And, you know, maybe we've been too dismissive of those. You know, maybe it's possible that might be seeing something like a low end modem or something like that. I asked, maybe put over on the spot to say why that can't be.
That you can support such large scale flows with the MRI protocol. I mean, large scale protocol, but I definitely think that. Do you want me to give you a yes or no answer to that? It doesn't take much accretion to kill those modes. So no, my feeling is that if you're talking about a structure which is really that where you really have a transonic flow in the inner part, then my feeling is that you would want to see resistance. But I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, Ron has to leave a little early, so I'd like him to talk about some new and hopefully very relevant observations.
Mike, you want to? Oops.
Sorry. This is not a talk. The purpose at hand is to show some additional details from what you've heard from Rudy and Demetrius to excite you about the prospects that high-frequency QPOs and black hole binaries may, in fact, be a window into probing black holes of general relativity. But I have another motivation here in terms of the way that I want to make the point. I think involves a way to display data that allows a synthesis of all the things that you've heard today from Ann and Rob Fender about the states and the state changes in a way to just at a glance try to understand the different behaviors of the source. And I think for theorists it's especially important to become more comfortable with the behavior and not feel overwhelmed by a linear chain of stories that seem to be hard to inspect in one swoop. So we'll start out with 1655 minus 40. And I've taken the same data and I've analyzed it in two different ways just to try to reassure you that the conclusions that you might draw from the features here don't depend on the integration limits. You can either look in the PCA window 2 to 25 keV essentially, or seek bolometric limits and you get the same conclusions. So forgive the fact that it's double and just pay attention to one side only, you'll get the same answer. Now, as far as the high frequency QPOs, they are blue symbols here, and the open star shows where 450 hertz was detected, the solid box shows where 300 hertz QPO was detected, and the solid star shows when we see both of them. Now, all this plot is a very simple deconvolution of the energy spectrum into the amount of flux from the disk and the amount of flux from the power law. But there are a lot of things that you can read from these plots to answer questions like Julian's been asking almost all week. When is it in this state? When is it in that state? What are the transitions like? Because it comes out of the diagram. These red X's along the bottom, I mean, if you just stop from first principles, what are Shakur-Sanyaev disk is basically a line, essentially, along the horizontal axis. Until you start adding radiative transfer effects in an atmosphere or start imposing a corona on the situation, there is no power law flux. Okay? And in fact, an appreciable set of the observations with the red X's here do show what looks like a purely thermal branch that the source is happy to be in. There's some curvature at the top here, and one could even suspect strongly that that's where, in fact, the atmosphere or the thickening of the disk, as predicted, actually starts to add some comptonization to the spectrum, but still squarely within the confines of a thermal disk. Now, what happens in 1655 minus 40 is that we race to the end of this branch, and there are hard flares with a power law, blooms, that proceed off the tip. And then, in the context of all of our discussions, this would appear to look like the onset of magnetization in the disk, but from the observer's point of view, you can go way up here and come back down again on a time scale of 2 days or 3 days. So to someone who's been through these observations, when we're watching the MHD simulations movie and we see all the wonderful turbulence and waves start to go in the disk, you wonder, well, when's it going to go off? Or under what conditions will it slide back down here and demagnetize on a time scale of 1 to 2 days? But that's what the source does. And with a little help of correlating these diagrams with the timeline, you can read these off of these simple diagrams that show the energy budget. So later I'll show you another source where you can pick out the hard state, but in general, this is the high state. The low hard state with radio emission lies on a vertical line, and Mike Muno in 1999 et al. Showed that there was a very strong vertical line track for steady observations of 1915 plus 10, which in fact were all radio loud and out of the same low hard state connected to with a steady jet that you've heard about from Ann and Rob. Now, this so-called very high state is all of this stuff in between, where you do have substantial disk flux, and as you come out here from whatever direction, either from the thermal track or from the low hard state, when you come out here into this region, you'll quench the jet, but often when you traverse from the hard state to the very high state, you seem to go through an instability strip in some parameter space where you set off the ballistic jets, the ones that are famous for defining the microquasars and show us the knots that travel out at superluminal apparent speeds. So from what you've heard today, I mean, Shakur and Sunyaev essentially have a prescription for handling essentially this the horizontal track. And I think the vertical track and the spectral energy distributions that Rob showed are at least in hand of having a sense of what may be going on with the jet and compensation at the base of the jet in the case of steady jets. But I think this is the problem, this so-called very high state, where you get a mixture of the two. And it's very important to note, I think, that the power law index here is around 1.7 generally, and you get a flatter non-thermal index here around 2.5. So when the Gamma Ray Observatory made the statement several years back that there were two types of power laws, that notion in the observing community is still quite strong and distinguishes the power law here from the power law that you get in the vertical track, which is radio loud. Now on to QPOs. What's very interesting now, and the main thing that's happened in high-frequency QPOs in the past 3 years, is this business of having pairs of high-frequency QPOs and black hole systems, as Rudy described and as Dimitrios also addressed. What I'm trying to do to energize the discussion here and show the stakes is illustrate the connection of these QPOs to the very high state, and conclude thereby that from communicating with theorists, the really important thing to solve is this very high state. I agree with exactly with what Jean-Pierre said earlier this afternoon. When we get 450 hertz QPOs, it's these three points right here. The solid stars represent when we get both QPOs, and when we get 300 hertz QPOs are the boxes that live up here. So even though there are not a lot of data points here, there's a clear progression up the track in when we get the what what we're calling now the 3 omega versus the 2 omega, because part of the process here is the belief that this ratio of 3 halves is not an accident. So if you buy the sum of the evidence for this source and for 1550 that these QPOs live in 1, 2, 3 harmonic combinations, then all of these blue symbols are representations of a single frequency system. And it means this frequency system is quite robust to the amount of flaring in this power law component, which we don't understand. Okay, now let me just quickly talk about 1550, which is much more dramatic. But I would hope to convince you that even though this looks like a mess, it is not a cause for despair, because it shares many of the same basic properties of what we saw in the simpler system. This is 1998-1999 outburst in 1550. You can just again look at one side. It has a nice thermal track, same amount of curvature, but the flares in the power law can proceed from just about any point along here. They don't seem to have to run to the end of the track and saturate an energy in some way before flaring. They can pop up from any point here. So from a sort of naive reading of the data, it now has another sense of magnetization, that not only can you switch it on and off at fairly rapid time scales, but in terms of luminosity, you can switch magnetization on and off at somewhat arbitrary levels of the energy in the disk. But we're stuck with that point of view. But as the observing community, the sense is, well, let's just embrace this and go with it and try to figure out how we're going to understand it and how we're going to model it. In terms of the QPOs, there are 28 detections, and most of them are either near 270 hertz or 180 hertz. The symbols are similar. The 3 omega has an open symbol. The 2 omega has a solid box. And again, all of the open stars cluster around the disk line. And as you ascend the branch here, including this super flare in the source, you get solid symbols. So it appears it goes from the 3 omega to 2 omega, along with the strength of the power law component. The 3 to 2 ratio again appears in the system. We don't think it's an accident. We know the masses of both systems, and the masses scale as 1 over nu 0, which is incredibly encouraging for the whole business of finding a way to probe black holes through GR. And here now, if this, all these blue symbols are again one frequency system, we have point way up here expressing the same frequency system as some of the stars embedded way down here, which is now more than a factor of 10. So these kinds of diagrams allow you to just read off the answers in a way that I think is part of the utility of displaying the data like this with coded symbols. Just very quickly, the outburst of 2000 in 1550 shows reduced levels in flux, but again, you have these same symbols that occur near the disk line. Here you can see the vertical branch, that's the heart state that Rob Fender talked about. So it looks like these QPOs are very robust in terms of coming back in the same system and persisting despite factors of 10 changes in luminosity. The 3 to 2 ratio seems to be some indication of resonance. The 1 over m relation between the two sources seems to be entirely consistent with GR. So we think that these double QPOs have strongly increased the prospect of finding a pathway to applications of GR in black hole binaries. Now, I'll only show one more quick view graph, and I'll preface it with this last one. In the case of 1915 plus 10, we know we have this very strong vertical branch with a steady jet, and we have also a thermal branch with a little curl up, as we have in the other sources. And 67 hertz lies way out here for the most part. It's dotted along the thermal branch, but a lot of it lies to the right of the curl up, where you think that the disk is thickening up. We don't have any explanation for that, but if these patterns are common in all black hole binaries, then the motivation upon completing the analysis of these sources was to try to look for some analog for the 2 omega QPO in this section of the flux division for 1915 plus 10. Now, steady observations don't go into this zone, but these flip-flopping wire light curves for 1915 plus 10 have segments where the spectrum is hard and luminous, and it does momentarily go into this zone. So as an exercise to see if we're learning how to track these QPOs, I took a series of observations where there were radio quiet conditions and square waves that were flip-flopping with soft dips and strong hard X-ray emission, and just used the flip-flop times to define time windows where I could feed the data through these windows and sort out the power spectra into bins related to the spectral characteristics of the flip or the flop or the points in between. And that, just last week, turned out to be a productive exercise. And what I get out of the strongest soft dip episodes for 1915 plus 10 in that high power law flux zone is what looks to be a set of QPOs. The Six Sigma bump at 164 hertz and around a 4 sigma, 3 to 4 sigma bump around at 2 nu, so twice 164 hertz. And even the sign that maybe if you keep this exercise up and find enough data, you may even find a 3 nu. So it's very exciting and productive from the point of view of understanding black holes to continue to pursue QPO searches in the framework of these energy diagrams. And I think the prospects are very exciting that if we have another powwow in 3 years, and then all the people in the various models for disco seismology and resonances have time to think about adapting to 1 omega, 2 omega, 3 omega, we may have a solid prescription of how to define mass and spin of black holes using X-ray power spectra. And just I'll say one more note, connecting to something Bob had suggested. For me, the fact that any point back in these energy diagrams, that any observation in this zone can yield information about resonances that are incredibly diagnostic in terms of black hole mass and spin, immune to absorption and able to be measured very accurately, for me, it was the first time that I really felt that XTE was inadequate, even with its tens of thousands of counts per second, because it would be really wonderful to see these harmonic systems in every observation. And I think that it creates an argument for really doing disco seismology with much higher accuracy and not having to add up so many observations. So I think Demetrius also expressed this, but I certainly will agree wholeheartedly that we should think about that going forward. So it sounded like a talk, but it wasn't really a talk.
I hope that provoked some questions. Yeah?
Ron, I'm not quite sure you're tuning you for GRS 1950 is 300 and something hertz. Right? And your tune you for 1655 is 300 hertz. Right? But that, so from, you said this is related to 1 over the mass, so that this means that the mass in 1915 should be less than that in 1655, but it's been measured in 1915 to be 14.
The 1 over M business has to be, it's mass and spin. So the excitement of having 1 over M unite the frequencies means that 1655 and 1550 must also have the same spin. So if I only have 3 objects and 2 parameters, then if I know the mass of the black hole is 14 solar masses, all I would do to make it analogous is say it's a slightly higher spin parameter. And not all of the ways of understanding the frequencies require 0.9C. And there's one particular interpretation of resonances that Ludwig Kluzniak has published with Abramowitz would imply, and Strohmeyer's taking a stab at understanding where these frequencies may lie, would suggest 0.3 as the value of the dimensionless spin parameter. So maybe 1915 has 0.4 at 14 solar masses, and it's not a problem. because there are two parameters.
Okay, but then if you identify you're too new, you can't say you can get the mass from this.
Right.
Are you telling me that it's n squared minus a squared square root? Because I don't see how it's what it scales with the mass. The mass is exactly the wrong way down.
If the frequency scales as 1 over m for the optically measured masses of the two systems, the new zero value, there's a factor of 1.6, and the higher frequency goes with the lower mass. So if you have a low value of spin and things are basically 1 over m, no, 1915 would not agree in a line, would not agree on the same line as the other two.
Sorry, what? I think in the last 50
words. I just said 1915 doesn't agree with this idea that it goes as one over mass without there being another parameter. So, and so,
so it might be just higher, a slightly higher spin.
Maybe someone can write down the phone number, the mass.
I have it on a new grid.
Okay. That would probably be useful.
So you'll see it soon.
Well, I can understand 1 over the mass if that was a length, right? That would make a lot of sense.
How come? This will be addressed. What else?
Also, this source could be also be around 160, 180, similar to 4 or 5 of the other ones. That then you have to modify the mass and the spin in such a way that they produce the QPOs there. So that's something else. What's going on?
Something else.
I don't know. It's very coincident that the QPOs all, there's 50-50 FQPOs 180. But this one is 160.
Yeah,
8059 is 180.
No, but look, if you look at the instrument, if you think of the PCA,
yeah,
and you're the PCA, the neutron stars are doing kilohertz QPOs. Yeah. So there's plenty of action down there. We see nothing of that in the black hole.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come just make an ordinal list. What has been seen? If you accept these for two and allow the 2 omega 1, then you have a 450, a 328, a 300, a 184, a 164, a 160, and the 65 from Emmer's poster. They're all over the place. I mean,
No, the most pronounced QPOs are somewhere around 160 and 180, and then a 280 or 50-50, and then 65 are quite different. But there are three or four sources which shows the pronounced QPOs at 160 or 180. This one is one of them, because the 180 is 160 is more stronger and more pronounced than the 102 2000 frequency.
Right, but then the optical distribution of measured masses from the binary analysis are clustered between 7 and 14 also. So, I mean, wouldn't
you have to have, in order to for this to be what Rob says, you have to introduce a spin again, and then the spin should be different, but in such a way that's very nice to correlate again, that you have frequencies at a very narrow frequency range. And that's just, it's possible, but it's stretching, I think.
It's 60 hertz before 50 hertz, the narrow frequency.
So 160 to 180 or 170, that is one of the dominant frequency ranges in this black hole candidates now at high frequency. And
but at lower
frequencies,
lower frequencies.
Yeah, but there's almost like different kinds of QPOs.
Well, I lost this point in his talk.
QPOs show simultaneously up with QPOs around 6 to 12 hertz. And that is looks like another kind of QPO, not related to the high frequency QPOs.
Well, I don't think it's an artifact.
I think it's coming from the fundamental. It's really something to do with the mass and the spin. That they correlate so well that it always has the same frequency, or is it something else going on in the disk or some other fundamental property we don't understand yet?
Okay, I think we should delay this discussion.
I'm sorry to ask a question, perhaps more of the theorist than the observer, the phenomenologist. When you see these harmonics, is the thought that you are exciting modes that have a harmonic structure in the disk, or that there's one mode that is excited, and because perhaps of relativistic beaming and so on, you're essentially doing the Fourier analysis of it and seeing harmonics come out from one individual mode?
can't answer that because I don't work on those.
Well, I think Bob would say that.
I'm going to say it.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
All right, let me say it now.
Okay.
I don't want to leave. I want to. You have to keep moving at some finite rate to get to everything. But. Okay. All right, so I thought I'd make a few remarks which may be useful about disco seismology.
Thank you.
This is a standard plot, but not one that all of you have seen. But just to make a point which others have made, especially Dimitris. Okay, so I'm plotting here various frequency squared versus distance in the usual units for three measures of black hole spin from non-rotating to almost maximally rotating. Okay, and I've indicated the position of the horizon, etc. And here we have the angular velocity, the vertical epicyclic frequency, and the radial epicyclic frequency, kappa squared. Kappa squared traps the G modes and also traps the P modes between the inner edge of the disk and possibly between the outer edge of the disk here. And there's another class of modes related to the difference between these two frequencies, which is essentially the Lenz-Tering frequency. Okay? And the basis, these are just orbital frequencies of free particles, but they're the fundamental input into the normal mode analysis, which in principle describes all perturbations of your disk model. Okay, are included in the normal modes that we analyze. In principle, any perturbation is a linear combination of these normal modes. Okay, where do the modes live? This might be useful for what we have to say. Okay, there's the spin parameter. There's the inner radius of the disk running down to 1 for maximally rotating Kerr. Okay. So here's where the P mode lives, the inner P mode, and these are just the fundamental modes. I'll talk about, if you have the stomach, the other harmonics, okay, the radial, angular, and vertical harmonics if you want, but these are the fundamental modes. This is the C mode, which gets pretty big for very slowly rotating black holes, called the corrugation mode by Cato. These are acoustic inertial modes, and these are gravity centrifugal modes. So these are the most robust because they don't are not influenced by the uncertain physics at the inner edge of the disk. Okay? And they cover more area where the disk has more luminosity per unit area out here. Okay, so those are the M equals. So these are all the fundamentals.
Bob, can you remind me, so the G modes do not rely on the maximum up in the
Yes. These are controlled by the epicyclic frequency. Okay. The frequency is very close to the maximum epicyclic frequency.
So you still need that maximum of the epicyclic frequency to exist in the flow for the existence of the trapping of those modes.
Right, for all of them, right. Well, not for the C modes. For the P modes, we need to trap the P modes. We need to turn over to trap the P modes, okay? And we need to turn over to trap the G modes, but not the C modes, okay?
Are you worried about that? And you need that? I mean, do you think that it's realistic and that such a maximum in the epicyclic frequency exists in the real flows of nature?
I'm somewhat optimistic, again, because most of the problems occur near the inner edge, okay, in the disk models, in my opinion, okay? The problems get worse as you approach the inner edge. Let's put it that way.
That's a fair answer.
Okay.
That if one is a G mode, one is a C mode, that might be good because we can nail down on the M angular momentum plane.
I'm coming to that right
you
now.
You just said that the inner ones are going to depend somewhat strongly upon the conditions at the inner edge of the disk. So if you're not sure that they exist, are you suggesting that the second plot that you just showed, the two G modes and harmonics, is probably the better one to be looking at?
No, I'll explain why in a coming up soon, okay? Let me say the C mode is an almost incompressible wave, okay, which precesses around the spin of the black hole.
Okay, so it's almost incompressible. So it's less sensitive to the physics of the inner edge than the acoustic P modes, okay, which keep slopping matter over the inner edge onto the black hole. Whereas these are just tilting, just a tilting mode. M equal 1, tilt, the C mode. There we modulate the X-rays by different projected angles. So the mode has different projected areas. So the mode, the projected area of the mode varies during the period, okay? So that's the modulation mechanism for the C modes, whereas these are compressional modulations of the temperature and density, and therefore the X-rays. Okay? And these are compressional too, of course. But we focus on the C modes because they're more robust, okay? And that's the main reason. They're more robust than the P modes, we feel. Less uncertain, I would say. Okay, so here's the basic plot. For the fundamental modes only, where the thickness of each curve represents a range of luminosities from 1/100th of Eddington to Eddington. The frequencies are not exactly stable, and they do depend weakly on the luminosity, that is the speed of sound. The only thing the modes know about is the speed of sound in the disk, and of course that's related to the luminosity. So you can see roughly the dependence on luminosity from the width of the lines. Also, for the P modes, we have two possibilities we've shown here, depending upon our lack of inner knowledge what's going on in the innermost stable orbit. Okay, from the standard model of no torque, okay, to a torque which removes 5% of the angular momentum, okay, before it reaches the black hole, which is sort of similar to recent numerical simulations. Okay. So we have taken an account of our lack of knowledge of how much torque there is due to the magnetic fields at the inner edge of the disk, okay, in these two cases. So that reflects our uncertainty in the P modes. Okay, so this is the fundamental diagram, and I'll show you how we use it. Okay, but before we go to that, to answer your question, for the higher G modes, we'll look at the higher axial modes. Here is the location and fractional width of the higher axial harmonics of the fundamental axisymmetric G mode. So as you go to higher harmonics, they get closer to the inner edge and they get much narrower. And it's not closer to the inner edge and much narrower, so much harder to modulate the luminosity. Okay? But the interesting thing is, which may be interesting, that the ratio of the frequencies of the M equal 1 to the M equal 0 G mode, okay, is roughly given by this equation because they live right near the inner edge of the disk. Okay? And so their frequencies are roughly M times the angular frequency at the inner edge of the disk, which is about 3 times the fundamental G mode. Here again is the fundamental G mode frequency versus A. Okay, this is the ratio to the fundamental. So interestingly enough, about a factor of 3 going up here. Okay, from one to the other. A little more than 3, okay, is the actual number. But that's useful to keep in mind. However, the bad news is the darn modes don't overlap, okay? So how you get any resonance between these modes is very difficult because the M equals 0 does not overlap with the higher M modes. Okay, finally, here's the way we do things. The first source we studied, the mass had been measured spectroscopically beforehand, okay? We knew of this frequency. We assigned it to the most robust mode. And with that mass, we got that spin. Okay? Then, this frequency was discovered in that system. So we had predicted the spin of that system at 0.92. Then, the higher frequency was discovered at 450. Okay, which happened to exactly equal that ratio, right? For this, for that spin, 0.92. So this fell right on the line of the C mode, the recent, the newly discovered frequency. So that was a prediction in a sense. So especially my co-authors got very excited. I'm a little less excited, but so the new frequency sat right here for the spin we had assigned. Okay, foolishly encouraged by that, we go on to the other sources that Ron talked about. So that was the assignment for that system. Okay, then we go on to 1915 plus 105. I'm ignoring the higher frequencies that Ron talked about that have just been discovered. Okay, these are the classic frequencies, this first discovered. Okay, this was first discovered. We assigned the G mode to this, okay, in a paper with Mitch and Mike and others. Okay. And then this guy was discovered. Okay, so if we assign this guy to the C mode, okay, then what do we have? So it's easy to remember, the frequency ratio gives you the spin of the black hole. Obviously, it's a dimensionless number, right? Frequency ratio gives you the spin of the black hole. Okay, so here we have, in this case, the higher frequency guy is the G mode, the lower frequency guy is the C mode. You take that ratio, it gives you a spin parameter of 0.7, and then you read off the mass. Okay, so you read off the mass. The predicted mass that we published was 18.2 plus or minus 3. A few months ago, Greiner announced the spectroscopic mass determination, which if we read his paper carefully, is actually a lower limit of 14 plus or minus 4 solar masses. So in a way, you can call this a test of whatever you want, but we predicted a mass and it was observed. Okay, so it tests some combination of the Kerr metric, disco seismology, or whatever. Okay, then we come to the next system, which Ron talked about. These two frequencies, neglecting these littler guys that he mentioned. Okay? These are the ones that are seen most frequently. They vary a lot, however, but it appears, and Ron can correct me, that when they vary, their ratio remains close to 3:2, okay? When you can observe them close together in time, okay? So here, as in this case, to be fair, we published two possible mass determinations, okay? Whether this guy, whether you assign the C or the G mode to the higher frequencies. You have two choices, so you have two mass determinations, okay? I don't have to show you the plot again, because for this case, right, we have the same ratio of frequencies, so we have the same spin if we assign the C mode to the higher guy, okay? That gives us this mass prediction, and here was the mass that's recently been spectroscopically determined for this system, okay? That's the situation as far as predicting masses. However, as I said, we really predict two masses depending upon your assignment here of which is G and which is C. Okay, and there's no, unfortunately, no obvious rule staring us in the face here, although we make, there's some other criteria that we can use, but that's the situation. Okay. Okay, I'm not going to say anything more except to say one sentence. We predict how the frequency should depend upon disk luminosity, how the frequency should depend on disk luminosity. Slowly, I'll give the numbers, but the important point here, for the G and C modes, the frequency decreases slowly with disk luminosity. For the P modes, the frequency increases slowly with disk luminosity. That's another prediction. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about disco seismology. Any questions before we move on to VLODEC? Yeah.
Okay, so forgive my ignorance. But it seems to me that if you want to say that this is what represents or what's generating QPOs, you have to make it in two assumptions. One is that the restoring forces involved here are going to be large compared to compression variations in the disk, if there is a homogeneity in the disk. The second is that inhomogeneity in the disk would be a sufficiently large scale, but they're going to be larger than the typical wavelengths of the books. And I was wondering, do you believe those two things? Am I just being naive?
Okay.
Or are you making predictions about...
Situation is the following, okay? For the fundamentals, the radio wavelengths are large compared to the turbulent cell size, okay? So we're integrating over many cells, okay? Of course, vertically, you have one turbulent cell, and that's the vertical wavelength, okay? Your other question is, you know, the main pressure is a minor player in all of this, okay? That's why the frequencies are close to these fundamental frequencies, Lens-Tearing frequency at the outer trapping radius. I'm sure the C-mode frequency is the lens-tearing frequency evaluated at the outer trapping radius, which we evaluate for our mode. Okay, so we have all the eigenfunctions for these modes, which you can inspect at your leisure. Now, what was the other? So, the restoring forces are small. The pressure effects are small. Okay, even for the P-modes. Okay. Smaller than the radio wavelengths, okay? And the restoring force is gravitational centrifugal, right? For this. We think they're excited and damped or driven by the turbulence, okay? They're just a set of oscillators damped and driven by turbulence. However, Mike found that the G modes actually grow due to viscosity. The P modes are damped. They're out of phase because pressure acts against the G modes and helps the P modes. I don't want to get into too many details, but okay? So the P modes are damped by viscosity. The G modes grow by viscosity. Okay, we estimated an amplitude. Mike, you answer it.
What was the question?
how do we guesstimate the amplitude? Okay,
you just pray to God it's big enough to be observable. I think that's really the answer. And possibly only because they're very low amplitude QPOs, which is why they're so difficult to actually see observationally. And actually, since I asked earlier a question of Roger that he didn't answer, let me not answer the question he asked before, which I think was a very good question, Roger, was that, is this two different modes, this 3-2, or is it harmonic structure? The answer is we really don't know, unfortunately. All we can see is that they, at some phases, both are present in the light curve at the same time. That as you ramp up the power law, you smoothly see the 450, the 300 disappear and the 450 grow. And there are some points where they do overlap and say that they are there at the same time. So it's possible that they're harmonic. In fact, actually, in the 1997 paper that Bob did with Ryan Smith, one of the things he said was that it was probably easier for the G-mode to modulate the first harmonic and the second harmonic. The fundamental is pressure modulation, condensing modulation. And that just sort of integrates itself out. The first harmonic is volume changes in this. Much harder to integrate out, so therefore probably much more robust. The third harmonic is sort of a coupling of volume with the pressure modulation. It's weak but better than the first, so it's easier to do the second and third. As Dimitri said in his talk, the big problem is that we don't even have a model of the DC condition for these things. So asking for an AC model is tough. But for any of these modes that we're talking about, I don't see why we couldn't have harmonic structure. The question is, can you think of a clever way of dialing the harmonic context with the power law plus, as opposed to dialing into the node context with the power law plus. Eventually, you just get a little more room. There's one of the two
power laws. Does it disturb you that, given the both things that I mentioned, there's no reason to
make it? Well, I
I agree. That does disturb.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm less disturbed.
Concept of a single mode, or it's not the goodness rate. I would probably prefer one of those.
Ron.
The harmonic that you're
going
up with no fundamental, and you get to go to that mode, you can do observation. So we don't, except for 1915, which is different, you saw big omega, little 2 omega, maybe 3 omega. In the other two cases, on a given day, we see one big spike at what later turns out to be 3 omega when we take the composite of observation. So, from the observational point of view, this does not look like a sine wave. It's a nice sine wave with no apparent harmonics at what later looks to be 3 omega.
Yeah. Okay, key point, right.
More about the number of people and less about thermodynamics, which is kind of related to these modes, which is the simplest possible way that you can see the 450 Hz is that you have 7 solar masses inside 30 m. And as far as I can tell, this is the best evidence for, you know, heavy concentration of mass, something relativistic. You can go to the second level, no matter what the mode is, and say it has to be something that is in stable orbit. That makes you 7 masses in 6M. And that's barely as much as general relativity can allow you to do it. My question is there, can I crank up the general relativity in gravity theory and leave from general relativity so that I will violate this condition and then say, therefore, this cannot be a good gravity solution? And of course, in general relativity, in the case of black holes, it's harder. In the case of neutron stars, we have 1200 Hz, which is very against 6M. And there's this paper by Damour who said that if you allow for a second order coupling between a scalar field and the metric, then the neutron stars become way too big. And actually, you calculate the biggest frequencies in there, at the outer radio of the neutron star, they're too big, they're too small to allow the 1200 Hz frequency that we see. So we can invert and learn something about the coupling just from the maximum frequency that we see. Can we learn something in the case of black holes from the fact that we have 400 Hz around 7 solar mass object? Scott was talking about similar things in the case of wind. Can we apply those things in this case? No matter what the modes in the hydrodynamics are, these frequencies are observed.
We have two particles without learning that. What we do to make a gravity theory is black hole like that. One of the problems is the most natural extension is that people talk about Brandt-Higgins Schwarzschild black hole, the same as the GR Schwarzschild black hole.
But Brandt-Higgins won't be made anything different than one of our five
times.
Well, we have a terrible problem now. We don't have any good alternatives to general relativity that make much of a difference for the systems we're talking about. If you wanted me to fiddle with general relativity and make it different, to make these predictions come out different, one not too contrived thing I could do is make a theory in which rotating black holes exist, but are always unstable and always spin down to a Schwarzschild black hole. That's a fairly small perturbation on general relativity. So I would turn that around and say to be able to prove observationally that a rotating black hole exists is a separate and equally important observational goal to show that black holes exist in the first place.
The fact that when you spin up, you bring in the orbits is a nice qualitative feature of Kerr, you know, which hopefully we can test. Okay, we better move on. Vlodek has a few words to say about resonances.
So I think the question that many of us have in the backs of our minds here is whether the actually observed QPOs are some disk fluid phenomenon which would occur also in a Newtonian background, or whether they are really a reflection of the strong field gravity present around black holes. And I'm not going to try to sell you to you a theory of resonance. Rather, I'm going to give you a historical account of how we were led to resonances with Marek Abramovich, and then you can make up your minds whether or not it is likely that the QPOs observed actually occur in Newtonian gravity. All right, so before there was Bondi and Hoyle, well, there was Kepler, and matter tends to move around in Keplerian orbits. That's an observed fact. And at least for some black holes, this is also true, and I refer you to the observations of water masers around some AGNs. This is one paper in which it is argued, simply based on the data, on the velocity measurements of the and position measurements of the water masers, that the disk is a thin disk and motion is Keplerian. Okay. Now, in Newtonian physics, of course, Keplerian rotation curve is completely featureless. There is no preferred scale, so you would not expect any preferred frequency, not even a single QPO, unless you introduce a scale. And this is a copy of the Nature article, or rather the front page of the Nature issue where the Miyoshi et al. Article appeared. As you can see in green, this is about zooming in on a black hole. Okay. What you see here is a reconstruction based on the data of the shape of the disk. This is a jet. The red dots are the water masers, and the blue dots are also the water masers. And there are two points to be made here. The disk really is observed to be thin. Second, as you can see, it's a warped disk. And I suppose if you assume that this snapshot corresponds to a steady state situation, this would be a zero frequency C mode that Bob was talking about, which simply corresponds to matter not only moving around this way, but also moving up and down. And for a spherically symmetric situation, this up and down frequency is always the same as this frequency, and that's why you have a nice warp like this. Okay, you can, of course, introduce a special radius by putting a star inside. Okay, for example, this could be a magnetized neutron star, which would truncate the disk at some radius, and then you would have a special Keplerian frequency, and the star itself could rotate. And this simple argument really works. This is a copy of an old article by Angelini and Parmar. So first let me discuss the situation. This is an X-ray pulsar, a strongly magnetized neutron star, 10 to the 12 Gauss field, more or less. So we know where the disk ends. We know the rotation period of the pulsar. And this is the power spectrum. So there is some noise. This is the frequency and its harmonics of the pulsar, very sharp lines. And on top of it, you see a QPO whose frequency corresponds to the Keplerian rotation at the inferred edge of the disk. So my suggestion would be, although maybe it is not glamorous, is to look at those Keplerian systems, to do more research into the X-ray pulsars and see whether we see any double QPO features in those systems. And in particular, whether we see any harmonic double QPO systems in those systems. Okay. Of course, as Bob pointed out, and everyone knows, in GR, there is a preferred time scale, sorry, length scale. In fact, you don't have to believe in GR, simply if you believe that C is a fundamental constant of dimension velocity. To make Kepler's third law dimensionally correct, you have to introduce a length scale. And this length scale is directly measured by optical observers. For example, for 1655 minus 40, without any theory at all, just from Kepler's law, it is measured to be 11 kilometers. And that's what the excitement is about, because if you interpret now the 300 Hertz frequency as something that may be orbital, then you see that you're very close to this length scale. And therefore, you're probing effects of strong field gravity. All right, so the big surprise was that you saw two QPOs in neutron star systems, not one, at high frequencies. And when thinking about this with Marek, we decided that the only way we can match the observed properties of these double QPOs and the low mass X-ray binaries is if we think of some kind of resonance in the disk. And well, since Bob mentioned predictions, let me tell you about our predictions. So this was submitted in December 2000, and the referee quite correctly pointed out that double QPOs are not observed in black holes, and on top of it, there is no evidence for quantized frequencies. And this is, of course, correct, but since then, the situation has changed. Okay, we know at least two systems, and two out of three, I think, is a pretty good statistic in which you do see clear evidence of 3-to-2 ratios of QPOs. So I think it is very clear that there is some kind of resonance going on, and the only question is what kind of resonance. Okay, and perhaps the 3-to-2 ratio is not accidental. If you think of a resonance between two modes with frequencies of which one is greater than the other, and in particular if you think of parametric resonance, then from classical mechanics this is the relation between the two frequencies, 2/n, and if one is to be less than the other, then the fastest growing mode is in fact 2/3. So a 3-to-2 ratio is very natural if you have a parametric resonance in a disk. So as I said, I'm not going to sell you the theory, but just to show you how this may appear. Okay, let me write down a fluid equation. The force term essentially has two components. One is the gravity term, which leads to the natural frequencies, what are they called, the epicyclic frequencies, up and down, and pressure corrections. And now, since we're talking about thin disks, the pressure corrections are supposed to be small, and you would tend to ignore those. Now, this can be reduced if you have in mind some kind of motion, and I'm not going to be specific, but Bob, for example, showed you some very nice modes. Okay, let me talk about either traveling waves, or more likely, and I have reasons for saying that, a localized mode, a localized region in the disk, which can execute, for example, up and down motion. Well, this equation of fluid dynamics can be reduced to an oscillator equation, and the frequencies, again, are given essentially by the natural frequencies of the gravitational field, plus small pressure corrections, which you would tend to ignore in all cases but one, when there is resonance. And the point is that if you excite some kind of mode with one frequency, then you may expect this term, the pressure term, to vary with that frequency also. And then it feeds back into the other equation. Okay, and you get an equation of, which formally is the equation of an oscillator undergoing parametric resonance. This is the pressure term, and if there is variation at the frequency, which is, for example, in a 2/3 ratio with the natural frequency of this oscillator, then you have parametric resonance. Thank you.
Okay, response?
Stunned.
Stunned or tired? Yeah.
I mean, in what sense physical? Well, as I said, I'm not here to sell the theory, but let me make a statement first, that there are these modes that for some reason are not popular but have been discussed by Spiegel and others, which correspond to vortices. Okay, and at the inner edge of the disk, the vorticity of the background flow goes to zero, and what Spiegel has found is that if he puts in by hand a perturbation with large relative, not large, but a finite relative vorticity, it persists. So it seems much easier in a region where the background vorticity is zero for such perturbations to arise. That's one statement. The second statement is that motions that correspond to radial epicyclic motions actually in the comoving frame look like a spot on a disk, which counter-rotates with the epicyclic frequency. Okay, so what we have in mind really is a localized spot on the disk, which can execute up and down motion. Okay, and this up and down motion would be possibly excited by this parametric resonance. And of course, you know that parametric resonance gives like exponential growth of the amplitude. If you have another mode with the other frequency, okay? So if you have some small, that's the point. You need to have you don't need a large amplitude driver. You can have a small amplitude driver with this frequency to excite a large amplitude motion this way.
Hearing no more questions, let's move on, probably more rapidly. We should quit within a few minutes, is that correct, Jean-Pierre, according to the schedule? No, okay. Well,
how long do you want to stay?
Okay. I'd like to have Emra say a few words because what he's going to say is relevant in the following sense. In principle, it's a way, observationally, with some model of the corona, to find out where these modes are. Okay? That's the idea. Okay?
Okay. Come to the microscope and like the
It's a way to obtain the location of the QPO in the accretion disk. And the idea is simple. It's suppose we have a slab-like geometry where a hot Compton upscattering corona covers the accretion disk, and such that this corona has a temperature profile, and the temperature of the corona is cut close to the black hole and it decreases as you go away from the black hole. In such a model, if the QPO is close to the black hole, where it is under the hotter part of the corona, the modulated photons will be upscattered to the higher temperatures easily. So if you look at the RMS amplitude of the QPO as a function of energy, you will see an increasing relation. But if the QPO is generated away from the black hole such that the temperature of the corona is not that hot, and if you look at the RMS versus amplitude, you would probably see a turnover in the relation. Now, as far as I know, for all the high frequency QPOs, the RMS amplitude increases with energy, so 15, 15, 19, 15. So it shows us that the high frequency QPOs are really generated very close to the black hole. For low frequency QPOs, on the other hand, we showed for 1915, 1550 that there's a turnover in the RMS versus amplitude relation, so that they are probably generated somewhat away from the inner edge of the accretion disk. Now, if we can carefully model the coronal physical, if we can carefully model the coronal properties and these properties, then we can get, I don't know if we can, how precise we can get, but we can get where the QPO is originated as some kind of a number, and then we can test, for example, we can see if it is less than the marginal stable orbit or not, and then we can see if the black hole is rotating or not. if we can carefully model this system. So this is all.
So it's getting late. We should end soon. Let me just put up some of the other topics I mentioned. Does anybody have a quick comment before we disperse? No, you're saturated or overwhelmed or something. But what? Yeah.
Maybe there is some point that we can add to the computational way from the top point. Another way to detect the black hole could be to observe the quasi-normal mode, the ringing mode, after a black hole coalescence, binary black hole coalescence, because it seems difficult to reproduce these modes, which are quite characteristic in nature. It seems difficult to reproduce this with stellar-like objects.
Oh, no, excellent point. Yeah, the quasi-normal modes are a relatively clean way of probing the black hole metric. Good point. So a main theme that goes through a lot of this in my mind is to find robust probes, you know, which are insensitive to the astrophysics you don't know, okay, so that you can have some confidence in your probe of the black hole. So we're searching, you know, for robust probes, and I hope there'll be continued evolution in this subject. And I think numerical simulations are going to play a great role in much of this. So I thank you for attending, and have a good trip.